Good morning. How are you, Kent?
Very well, thank you. How are you
Awesome.
doing?
I'm great. I'm so happy that you accepted my invite, and we are talking now about some issues we have in the like from my like my region. We like as any country, like third world country. I'm from Egypt, so basically, we try to learn from the more civilized. We import books, we import everything. So some people talk a lot about like agile and what constitutes it, and they basically the problem that we have is we are following too much books. We don't have our own like we don't put our touch on it. So we are at a point where the process became more important than people, and like the customer and the people who work on the software. And basically, I have sent you some questions, and one of the things that basically, like personally, I had to deal with is when the people who manage the projects get in the way. And basically, I'm a software engineer. I know the problem. I'm trying to fix it. I go meet the client sometimes, and I know exactly what they need, but I have to go through so many things. Sometimes I have to shut up because it's my living. I can't do much about it. And sometimes I can resist. But from your perspective, like, what is the argument that we can make that this is not gonna work and it's hurting the client and us? Because basically, it's a very limited vision for what the owner want or the project owner want versus what actually need to be done.
Yeah, so I'm managing a team right now that where we have a complicated project. We don't have the opportunity for frequent feedback. Really, only once a quarter do we get to see new functionality go live. And the pressure on me and on our team to provide precise predictions of what we're going to do in the future, it's really intense. And so the first thing I do when I'm faced with that kind of situation, the easiest thing to do would be to just cave in. And okay, they want a prediction, I'll make a prediction. And that creates a horrible situation for everyone involved because I know it's not true. The customer knows it's not true. My managers know it's not true. Like everybody knows that this is, it's just not the truth. You know, here's where we're going to be. Here's the feature I'm going to add in the 9th month. Like, nobody knows. And once you make that prediction, now you've gone, you're negatively convex. So one of the tools that I use to think about situations is this idea of convex versus concave. Convex is a situation where you have a small investment, and most of the time you lose it, and every once in a while you have a big gain. So a lottery ticket is convex. Reading a book is convex. Because usually you read a book, it's not going to change you very much. But every once in a while, it completely changes how you think about something. So convex situations create the possibility of big outcomes. But a negatively convex situation is one where usually you don't gain very much, and every once in a while you lose everything. So when you're in when I've made that prediction, I've become negatively convex because if I hit my prediction, I'll get a little pat on my bald head. And if I miss it though, I might get fired, I'll get yelled at, I'll be told, shame on you. Blah, 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 blah. So that's a horrible position for me to be in. What happens if a month into this 9-month project we realize, oh no, this is a wrong direction to go, and we want to go in a completely different direction? We have a strong incentive not to change at that point. if you can establish a relationship, and this is hard work and it took us quite a while, if you can establish a relationship where you're discovering what to do together and everybody trusts, all right, the team's going as fast as they can go, and they're learning and they're going faster tomorrow than they went today. Okay. Well, we don't need, in that case, you don't need to predict exactly where you're going to be. So to me, that's the key difference is people want to avoid relationships and replace it with rigor, with false precision. Because, you know, that long-term prediction is very precise in a way, even though it's not true. And relationships are, like all relationships, are messy, and you gotta negotiate, and you're gonna do some stuff that damages the relationship sometime, and you have to make up for it, and like, yeah, it's that's hard work, but I don't see another way to get to really good outcomes with software development.
The thing is, the owners like of those projects and the management think basically like we heard about the like being the like they basically read about like agile and it can solve lots of problems and this kind of thing. Then they dig in and they find the Scrum Masters and let's do that. Let's teach people how the problem is the people, they don't understand what to do, and we will bring more people, like more process to like engineer their like life inside this 8 hours work. And at the end it's still like it's fake. I see it as fake because people sometimes doing it, like yes, I don't understand why I'm doing this, but I'm doing it because they ask me to do. It took me at least 5 years to understand. It's like, yeah, that's useful, but no one explained it like in a way where I can comprehend what should I do in this process. How can I optimize it? Like even now, when I understood it, I decided to cut off some pieces because I don't see use for it in my day-to-day work. And I added more stuff, like maybe some documentation. And instead of meeting, let's like write a collaborative document, because people are in different time zones, and we shouldn't have like to make everyone miserable to have like 1 hour meeting or something. So from your perspective, the concepts that the whole industry of people building on that engineers don't understand what they have to do. What do you think about that?
So I was in the same position 25 years ago when I was asked to lead this team at Chrysler. There was lots of advice for how to develop software, and you need these documents, and you need da, 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 da. And I also didn't understand. I at that point I'd had 10, 12 years of professional programming experience, and it still didn't make any sense to me. And so I just decided to stop. I said, if I don't understand it, I'm not going to do it, and we'll see what happens next. Like, maybe it'll be a disaster. Maybe all the books were right and my intuition was wrong. The three things that I know are essential to a programming project are listening, because everybody doesn't know the same things, and the creation of the software changes the landscape. So even if you started out knowing everything, the first line of code you write changes the world. So you don't want you now you don't know everything anymore. So we have to listen to each other. We have to write programs. We know that. Because without programming, there's not a programming project.
Yes.
There's a lot of other stuff that has to, you know, that needs to happen. We have to listen to each other because we need to learn. We have to write programs. And the third one is we have to write tests. Because as programmers, we make mistakes. We want some things to remain the same. And we want to ensure that that's true. We want some things to change. We want to ensure that that's true. So those are the three basics, and everything else is window dressing on that. Now, that's a very programmer-centric way of looking at the world. Designers have a strong role to play in development too, but not at the expense of those activities. I'm seeing a return of waterfall style development. Okay. You know, I'm old enough now. I start saying kids these days. Ugh, kids these days. I have kids these days come up to me and say, you know, we have this chaotic, messy process. If we just wrote down exactly what we were going to do before we did it, you know, this all would be so much simpler. And I'd say, kid, yeah, that doesn't work. Let me tell you some stories.
Yeah.
And, but like, if that process worked, it'd be great. Everybody would be able to see exactly what was going to happen. Then that's exactly what would happen. And we're finished. Oh, it's a wonderful story. And it's too bad that it doesn't work. Not at all.
Mm-hmm. Do you think the problem that we usually face is because we are not capable of understanding what need to be done, or is it the platform that we are building on is not stable enough, or like, because when I look at it, sometimes it's the assumption that I have about the problem is the problem. It's like, yeah, I think I know what need to be done. Then the more I work, the more I understand more, the more it's like, oh my God, I didn't fully understand last month. It's like, that's like too much information in like this during time, and I need to change stuff. So it's like going that the decision to go somewhere is like, yeah, I want to go there, but the path is like, I assume it's a certain way, I will dig it in a certain way, but it doesn't ever work the way I expect it to work. From my perspective, from your perspective, I mean, do you think it's our understanding? It's like, we don't leave enough clues for ourselves to like know how did we get there? Or should we, for example, now I feel that documentation very important. It's like 5 years ago, it's like code is documentation and that's it. It's like, I don't need to write more documents. But now, given that it's the architecture, it's like basically needs a documentation. It's like it can't be represented because code is like very.
hang on. Right. So this is another kids these days moment for me.
Yeah, sure.
Back in the day, oh, we have to document absolutely everything. So we had literally tons. Shelves full of printed paper that no one ever read.
Okay.
So here's the problem. I'm not going to tell you don't write docs. I'm going to lay out a process by which you can figure out which docs you should write.
Okay.
Documenting something has leverage when the information doesn't change much and the audience is large.
Okay.
Right, we're in a trade-off. This is my symbol for a trade-off. Mm-hmm. We're in a trade-off space. So JUnit is a good example where the JUnit API, you know, we had, while I was working on the project, we had really, really two generations where it wasn't changing very much. The API wasn't changing very much, and there were a million people using it.
Yeah.
So it makes perfect sense to write documentation if you're, you know, you should document more.
Yeah.
If you're in that kind of world, let's say you're in an internal project. It's just you and one other person. Somebody comes in, it's tempting to say, well, I should write documents for them, but there's no leverage. It's much faster to just explain it to them. You know, let's get in, let's pair on some tasks, and then you'll understand. And along the way, I'll say, well, why are things like this? And you say, sometimes you say, well, there's a good reason for that, da 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 da. Sometimes you say, oh, no, it was just a mistake, let's fix it. Or that was a mistake. I'd like to fix it, but I don't have time. Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. It feels good to document things. There is value in it to you as the writer you're forced to understand things better, but you're in a trade-off space. And if the information is changing all the time, or if the audience is small, there's not a lot of leverage in documentation. So write all the documents you want. If no one ever reads the document that you wrote, stop writing it.
Okay. What if the team is sort of like big and the responsibility is to like high level architecture, so people can start doing their parts? Like it's a system that has like maybe 7-6 microservices, and each and everyone will be working on it, and there should be some contracts between those services. And this kind of situation requires, I think it requires, some sort of documentation. Maybe everyone can change it, because there's contracts in those documents. It's like people will follow those. Don't you think that like in this area it requires some sort of documentation, at least for future people maintainers to know what, like, why did we this way, especially in projects that has iteration of people, like if like people come and go, so it's like we want to know like the history of this piece.
So I understand the desire to do that. It would be nice to if you didn't have to explain stuff. If somebody new comes in and you know, you just say, well, here's the doc, read the doc. And the documents, this is where the stable information and
the curve, yeah,
audience,
yes, yeah,
changes.
Yes, yeah.
So
yeah.
So if that information, let's say we write the document.
Yeah.
And then the contracts change, because they should change, because we're going to learn stuff. And if we learn stuff and we don't change the contracts, then reality and the ideal
diverge. Yeah.
And the reality diverge more and more.
Yeah.
So we don't want that. So we're going to change it all the time. So every time we change a contract, now we have to change the document too.
Okay.
The more thoroughly we've documented, the harder that becomes.
Yeah.
Eventually, we just stop changing the docs. Secret.
Yes.
But it's true.
Yeah.
Now we paid the price to write the documents. We slowed down development to write the documents. And the documents that we wrote, by the time you need them, they're always wrong.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. The decisions, so, yes. Yeah.
So what are you going to do? Well, the extreme programming answer is we're going to rely on the same kind of social interactions that people use all the time for all kinds of stuff. You know, you're talking to your uncle, they start telling you stories. You know, well, this is, you know, oh yeah, the family's kind of messed up in this way. Let me tell you a funny story. Or here's why the family, a business, let's say that a family business, why do we do things this way? Oh, let me tell you a story about it. And the story sticks in your head. Mm-hmm. That's a social process. The information is elicited at the moment it's needed. It's accurate because you're talking to a real person. The presentation of the information is adapted to you and to the relationship that you have. Mm-hmm. Those social processes work for many, many generations, sometimes thousands of years. Information gets passed generation to generation to generation, and it adapts and changes along the way. From an extreme programming perspective, we say, super.
Yeah.
That's good enough. Now, I'm not saying don't write documentation. Write all the documentation you want. If nobody reads it,
it's useless, yeah. It's very expensive.
If it's useless, stop doing it. Mm-hmm. Now, the one exception, and I've written two books about this, is code for communication.
Yeah.
So yeah. If you have a thought in your head and you can express it in the code, express it in the code. That's the one artifact we're guaranteed we have to have. And if you're focused on communicating through code, not just to the computer, but to the other people, then you can put a lot of information in there. Again, I didn't say don't write documentation. I said communicate through the code because you know that's the one artifact you absolutely know you have to have. So practice those habits so that you communicate through the code. And yeah.
I think the like maybe the like if we abstract the problem to the its core, it's communication, as you said. So communication first, it could be document, it could be code. Documents is like whatever cheaper method for communication is we should go for. Because we have to pay for code 100% all the time, then code is must exist, then we can emphasize more of our effort there instead of like having another channel or anything. In the same time, I was like thinking, do you think like things like TikTok, the technical talks and stuff like that, it's part of the social like engagement where it's like someone is explaining why we did that. I personally prefer 10 minutes video, someone explaining why they did, like why did they do that. It's like when people explain stuff about open source projects, it's like very enlightening. Do you think it's like videos, something like that, could be helpful, or still, like people might take it for granted and start building like huge libraries of videos that no one will ever see?
That's this. So that's why I'm not telling you what you should and shouldn't do. You should definitely try that and include analytics. If nobody ever listens to it or watches it, then stop doing it. What would be silly is you said, oh, I'm required to spend 40 hours recording professionally produced videos about, and no one ever watches it. And then the next week I have to do another 40 hours.
It's exhausting. Well, I was talking actually about like very cheap, like low production stuff, is like where presentations like explaining this.
I was pushing it to the extreme to make my point. So sure, try that. Some of those videos will be more popular than others. So, duplicate those. That makes sense to me. It's a relatively low opportunity cost. And if it has payoff, then yeah,
Keep
sure do
doing
it.
it, yeah.
But the what I mean, this is from 30 years ago, people would say, no, you have to absolutely document everything. And it's a nice simple rule. It's just wrong. It doesn't, it pretends that there's no judgment involved. And I would prefer, and this is from G-Paw Hill, I would prefer to rely on judgment, to accept the fact that you can have mistakes sometimes, but we're paying smart people to do this work. Why aren't we asking them to make smart decisions?
Exactly, yeah. Well,
Oh
yeah,
man,
I
that's a tweet right there. If somebody
yeah.
tweets it, I will definitely retweet that one.
This is cool. I was actually when you are talking about this, I feel again that, like going back to the core of the problem, which is communication. If we build a better communication tools to like GitHub, like or not GitHub, I mean Git in general and the history of commits. If we write clear messages, that's I think that's considerably enough to know what's going on. Why this decision? Why this line wrote this weird thing? It's like, oh yeah, because we had this disaster and the need to circumvent it, and that's why we have it here. No documentation, no search engine, nothing. It's just like open the history and that's it. That's totally fun. There is one question. I think you answered it implicitly, which is the relentless refactoring. I totally agree on it. But like. Can we just go through it? It's like the part, the diversion part, and how relentless refactoring like minimize the gap between the reality and the software.
Yeah, so if you accept that all the activities that you do in software development are continuous processes, so that's That's a basic assumption that I make, that testing's never done, coding's never done, designing's never done, deployment tools are never done. None of this stuff is ever done. It's all a process, and it's all going to continue. So that means you're going to spend some of your time designing as you go along. As you realize, oh, here's how I wish I'd designed it. Here's how it is designed. All right, am I gonna make the investment to bring the reality closer to the ideal state? Now let's look again at extremes. You have the cost
Yes.
of doing the design, and then you have the cost of not doing the design. And the shape of those curves change over time. So the cost of not doing the design starts out small, and then it grows and grows and grows. It's tempting. Okay, what are the mistakes that people make all the time? It's tempting to say we need to keep reality and our ideal really, really close. And the problem with that is sometimes you're wrong about your ideal. So we have some microservices, which I just call services, but there you go. And something's a little bit off, and so we rush to fix it. Well, if we rush to fix it and we fix it wrong, then untangling that is an expensive proposition. So one of the powerful properties of software is reversibility. We make some change, it's wrong, we just revert the diff, and we're back to the state we were in. If we haven't launched nuclear missiles or, told the government that we owe them $1 billion or whatever. So there, at the edges in software, we do make irreversible decisions, and we need to be careful about them, and we need to differentiate which ones we do. Nice thing about most design decisions is that they're easily reversible. So if a decision is easily reversible, you can go ahead and try it. And if it's wrong, we extract out a helper function. Have a big function, some segment of it makes sense. We extract it out. We just see, realize we're wrong. Okay, we just inline it. We're finished. So those, yeah, do those a little bit all the time. The bigger, the more irreversible decisions, like extracting out a service, that's harder to undo. If we extract out a service and start using it 20 different places and realize, ah, no, we needed it back with the rest of the code that was doing that. Now it's harder to do. So for those decisions, I want to wait a while. I want to let the mess get big enough that I can start to see what the shape should be. So part of being a software designer is waiting. Not being lazy, not ignoring the problem, but saying, okay, my problem isn't big enough yet. I'm feeling pain, and I'm not feeling enough pain to know what, to be confident that I know what to do about it. Because until I'm confident, okay, here's how the world should be, then I run this risk of doing the wrong thing to try and fix it. So, yeah, go ahead.
Sorry, go ahead. I was about like I was I was thinking that it's like building a statistical model where we want to make sure that our regression of the problem, the way we understand it, is clear, and this is how we should go. Then we have enough information, we have enough input of what is the ideal step, and instead of like small change that doesn't represent much, and we take a decision that's expensive and basically screw up another thing, or it wasn't ideal from the beginning. So the other question, given relentless refactoring, should we start by test driven, like with the refactoring, or like maybe changing what we have, like morphing it with the old unit, like tests, or like how should it go? Because there is old assumptions and the new assumptions. It's like
So my philosophy is always small, safe steps. It's rare. If I have a working system, I want to change it in small, safe steps because it's hard to get to a working system. Sometimes the smallest safe step is a big is it seems like a pretty big one. So you have some big service. This happened. I worked at Facebook for 7 years. We'd have some service, and everything at Facebook is big, you know. So you're storing a billion photos, but you need to store 10 billion photos. So you need to take all the billion photos off of the old service and put them onto this new service. Well, that transition process could easily take a year. And you're at every stage, you're just you stand up the new service and you try it out. And then you're writing new photos to both services at the same time. But then the new service gets in, and then you throw everything away and you start over again. And then you're writing, you know, one out of 100 photos to both services, and that one seems to be working. And then you write two out of 100, and then 50 out of 100. And then you're writing all the photos to both services all the time. And then now you start reading from both of them and checking, do I get the same answer from both? This is the only way to make this kind of transition. And it seems slow, but it's compared to what is always the question. You know, compared to failure? No, it's very fast compared to failing, throwing away all of everyone's photos, you know, having everyone leave your site and now your business is done. No, it's much faster than that. So it's working in small steps and staying safe the whole time. I think programmers underestimate that feeling of safety and how valuable it is. If you just know, hey, we're good. You're more creative. You're a better teammate. You project confidence to the other people who are affected by your decisions, so they trust you more. So a lot of good things happen. As programmers, somehow we get it in our minds that we ought to be at the absolute limits of our abilities. You know, we have these magnificent brains, and we want to absolutely use all of them all the time. So but remember, debugging is always harder than coding. So if you ever program at the limit of your abilities, you're guaranteed that you won't be able to debug that software.
Oh yeah, 100% agree. I used to spend. I used to work at Facebook too. It used to take me. I remember there were some bugs. Takes like 3 days to know what's going on. It's just debugging, like what's going on. It takes like 3 days to understand. Like yeah, this little tiny hidden magic number was like somewhere hidden, and it took those 3 days to figure out that that thing is there. And it takes like more 3 days to understand how to change that without blowing up everything. So it's pretty interesting. The more it's like basically the escalating the level of a challenge. It's like if you keep pushing like 100%, it's guaranteed that the challenge will be 120% next time.
And then you're stuck.
And it's miserable. I have a question about the test-driven development. You wrote the book 20 years ago, and like, what are the thoughts that changed since then?
Well, I have a n new generation. A student at one of my code camps came up with a new process that I really enjoy, and it's called the test, commit, revert. And it's written test and commit or revert because that's what the command line looks like. And in TCR, you make the change you want to make, and then if the tests all pass, then
Commit.
You automatically make a git revert. So now you can't go backwards, but you know everything's fine. If the tests fail, you immediately revert all the changes that you made. So if you program for an hour and then you press save and the test, I like it when the tests automatically run. You press save, the tests all run, poof, all your code just disappears. Oh, that feels so bad. I know I didn't make any mistakes, right? That's what we say as programmers all the time, and we're wrong all the time. So how can I break this change down into smaller and smaller and smaller steps? I have 3 lines of code, and if I type those 3 lines and I press save, they disappear. So how can I write one of them? Maybe I can write the middle line of code first, and everything will be fine. And then I can write the last line, and the two will work together, and then the first line. But now you've made real progress. Right now you have 2 lines of code, you're sure of what they do, and then you write the first line and then it just poof, it just disappears. Oh, I see. So TCR pushes you to make changes in even smaller steps. I thought with TDD I was taking small steps because it's one test at a time, right? Lots of people make that mistake. Oh, I'm going to write a bunch of tests and then make them work one by one. You don't do that. You write one test and you make it work, and then you write the next test and you make it work, and then you write the next. You can have a list. You can say, okay, negative inputs and the blah blah blah. You can have a list of stuff, but write one test at a time. Those are gigantic steps in the TCR world. In the TCR world, you're making one tiny little change at a time, and it's an intellectual puzzle. But the result is that you know exactly where you are all the time.
It's a slow down reinforcement. It's like you are forced to like slow down because if you write like tons of lines of code, it will boof disappear and you will have to write them back again. So it's like it encourages you. It's like my brain is like, hey, stop, write line by line and let's see what's going on. And if things are good, then it will keep going good. And also, I think it stop one of the bad habits I personally do, which is it's like it's not working. Okay, let me build more on that thing that doesn't work and keep pushing until it's like then it's like ugly 15 lines and then I need to reduce them. And instead of like thinking simply, it's the other way around. It's like yeah, let's make it small. I think I need to clarify one thing. That test commit revert like in one line, it's a bash if statement. It's if test passes, then commit else revert. So yeah,
Right.
that's the only thing.
So it's some root level of your project. You've got three scripts, and they're called test, commit, and revert. And the bash statement is test and commit or revert. And
Cool.
then that should trigger, like you want to trigger that all the time.
Yes. It, like regularly as much as the workflow like people are different. I like to basically keep build every couple of lines. That's my habit. So if other people like to write maybe pages and pages of code, then test them. That's also their jam. They can keep do that. And but still, yeah, the revert will be very painful.
Yeah, you can't do that in TCR. It just creates this powerful incentive to make sure. So I have a motto, for each hard change, make the change easy, which can be hard, then make the easy change. And TCR does that. You work extremely hard to make the changes to the code really easy. So it ends up not being like, at the end of a day, you're still, but the entire day you've made steady progress, and you never have to face panic. Not like, oh God, is this gonna work? Oh, maybe just push it to prod and we'll see what happens. Like sometimes that's your best situation, but if you feed yourself on a steady diet of that, you're gonna get stomach problems and migraines, and it's not good. And somehow, as programmers, though, we've internalized this belief that our job ought to be ought to be emotionally taxing. It ought to be scary. It ought to, And if instead it's just this smooth da 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 da, it that also feels good. You can learn for that to feel good, but somehow people just don't do that. I was the same. I decided, no, I don't want to feel panicked like that.
Same exactly. I got all sort of mental health issues because of work. Then I had to slow down. Therapist is like, you need to slow down. It's not gonna work. It's like you will kill yourself before you reach to the end line. So it's like, okay, I'm gonna stop. And yeah, I totally agree with you. There is like one question about the your experience at Facebook. Because I'm following you. Like I heard lots of podcasts you talk about. You said that you found yourself in coaching other engineers. And like, please tell me more about like what are the findings? What is the best way to help? Like if I'm responsible for other people, how can I up their game? How can I make them feel safe and the space open for them to grow?
So the first thing is this: the space has to be actually safe. You can't get somebody to feel safe if it's not actually safe. Well, what does that mean? As a yeah, go ahead.
Sorry, I interrupted you, but as long as we have the reviews and other people's opinions about our work, it's painful. I'm honestly one of the hard month in the year when like people judging me. It's like, did I do good this year? Am I worthy? It's like what? Then the fact that we live in this I hate this like giving feedback and because we are human, I like the aspect where you say it's a social. So going to uncle and talking, how we will sort this out in a family? It's we will never abandon anyone basically, and we will try to work with them. But what happens is like, you have like two shots, you lose them, then they get this weird program where we rehabilitating you to become like back as we found you. Then basically it becomes like weird. And it's hard. So sorry for interrupting you.
Yeah, no. This is a conversation. It's going to go back and forth. So when I came up as an engineer, I had the great good fortune of landing next to Ward Cunningham, the guy who invented the wiki. And at first he was like, yeah, you can watch me program, but don't touch my keyboard. And I'm 24 years old, more hair, fewer wrinkles, no gray. So I watched, literally just kind of just watched them in program for a while, and then I started noticing things. Oh, you missed a period there. Oh, the parentheses don't balance. Okay. So now I'm understanding what he's trying to accomplish as he's programming. And then eventually I'm asking questions. Well, it's called top and bottom here, and it's up and down there, and it seems to be the same thing. What's the difference? Oh, it should be called top and bottom both places. Oh, okay. So now I'm contributing. I'm the world's most expensive text editor, but at least I'm contributing. And then the conversations would sometimes we'd get in some sticky situation, and we have to roll back and go, wow, what's going on here? How is this different from this other situation we saw? And so we'd have conversations about it, and we'd dive back in. And then I started having ideas. Well, why don't we do this? I don't understand what you're talking about. Well, how about if I type for a while? So I have the keyboard just for a minute, like this. Oh yeah, I get it, I get it. And then he'd take the keyboard back. And we organically developed this pair programming style. I mean, it's not unique to us. Lots of programmers have worked in that style, but we developed this kind of back and forth. The whole time, there was no pressure on me to produce. I think this is a huge mistake that we make with young programmers now. We think everyone should be producing at their maximum capacity at all times. Well, then you don't invest in the next generation. And this organic process of passing knowledge on through the generations of programmers has fallen apart. And I saw that at Facebook. So I responded to it by recreating it. I would be the senior in that conversation with a bunch of juniors. And that was my highest leverage activity. So I spent most of my time doing that kind of coaching and then built this coaching program called Good to Great that matched up senior engineers with junior engineers and recreated that experience that I had had as a junior engineer, where you don't expect the juniors to like begin producing a lot right from the beginning. It's ridiculous. They're juniors. That's what it means. Let's make the investment to help them become senior engineers, to become fully productive engineers, well-rounded engineers. Let's make that investment. And that's a highly leveraged thing for a senior engineer to do. Now, that program at Facebook fell apart after I left and was canceled. Managers hated it because their senior engineers were wasting their time talking to juniors. This is an incentives problem. Those managers face really perverse incentives. They don't, they're what's good for them is not what's good for Facebook. It's not what's good for the engineers, either of the engineers, because both people get a lot out of this interaction. And still, I expect better of a manager. As a manager, you've accepted greater responsibility, and with that comes it's more important that you don't make bad decisions. So that coaching process really was a simulation of what I saw with my dad. And my dad was an engineer, electrical engineer, and then a software engineer growing up. I watched his interactions with junior engineers. I had that experience as I came out, and I wanted to recreate that. Now, you ask, how do you create safety? As a coach in that relationship, it's a really hard job. It's oftentimes an intellectual challenge to figure out, how am I going to reach? Here's somebody, I see what's blocking them, but I don't like, I would wake up in the middle of the night with ideas of, oh, maybe we try this and see what happened. The emotional challenge is even harder. To create safety for somebody else, you have to have your own act together. I don't know if that's a phrase that I'm not sure how that would translate. You have to be okay with yourself. If we're in a coaching situation and you say something and I'm reminded of some situation and I start to panic, like you're going to flip, you're like, I don't know what's wrong with this guy, but I shouldn't say stuff like that. It has to be really okay for you to come with your stories and say, okay, I'm in this situation. I think, okay, yeah, well, I've been there. Let me tell you a story about what went on. Most of the time, that relationship is based on storytelling.
That's
So
interesting. Yeah.
it's never technical stuff.
Oh,
Nobody
yeah.
ever wants me to explain test-driven development. Nobody ever wants me to explain refactoring. No, design patterns. None of no, it's like, oh, people think I'm such a jerk. Okay, well, we can talk about that. People think I'm a jerk too sometimes. So let's talk about what that's like. And to what degree are you actually a jerk? Okay, if you and I come together about that, and I don't think, oh, well, yes, you are a jerk, and I'm going to fix you. Right there. No, that's not it. It's like, hey, we're two people. I've experienced more of life than you have, just years, miles. I've been through this too. There have been periods in my life when I rubbed people really the wrong way. And here's what I did about it. What of that is about you? What of that's about them? I can't tell you that, but I can tell you. So it's kind of like that uncle telling you the stories.
Well, yeah, I feel that the biggest part is being at peace internally. It's like I'm at peace and being open to, like, because at peace means that nothing will trigger me as long as the conversation is going. Then the ground will feel, yeah, we can go, we can walk here. Then the more they talk, the more we like have a conversation, it's like a dance. Then the trust increase and we can have like more sophisticated conversations and we can keep doing it. But when I think about it, the environment at companies, it makes it slightly a little bit difficult. It's like, as you said, Facebook just canceled the project because they don't see where it's going. In the same time, when I think about it, that's the long-term thinking. It's not like the short-term. The long-term thinking says it's like if you can increase, at least increase the productivity of those junior engineers by maybe 10%. The like 10 engineers means that you hired one person and they are basically dying to hire more people. So thinking that you can increase the throughput of of the people, that's I don't know. It's a questionable why this is not like a good, like a thing. Maybe because it's not measurable, like we can't, it can't be measured. But
Not easily. So at Facebook, I mean, there was tremendous pressure to measure everything. And so HR studied the people that I had coached and found peers, people similar to those people who hadn't gotten coached. And they tried to be as scientific as possible, which I don't feel the need, but if somebody needs to do it, go ahead and do it. So they tried to be as scientific as possible and say, well, what was the effect of coaching? And what they discovered is the people who had gotten coached were twice as likely to get promoted in the year following coaching as the people who hadn't gotten coached. And increasing promotion velocity is a huge lever for an organization. So there are some numbers out there. I don't really trust it, but if somebody needs to do, like, I'm glad it confirmed. If they said no, everyone I coached left the company, that would be bad. But no, in fact, it does, like, from a even from a numbers perspective, I'm more interested in the qualitative perspective. I still have strong relationships with many of my students, and we still talk 8, 10 years later.
That's good.
I don't need numbers to convince me that this is a valuable activity.
Cool. Like, as we are talking about the HR and like people, like, what do you think about the hiring and interviewing new engineers? Because that's like one of the most I'm not gonna complete the question. Go ahead.
Oh, this is such a difficult process. And I don't have an answer.
Oh, and yeah, it's subjective.
I know that the hiring processes that a Google or a Facebook uses, they're faced with an impossible set of constraints. So as an engineer, I'd say it's an over-constrained situation. It should be unbiased. It has to scale to a funnel that starts with 1 million resumes and ends up with 10,000 hiring, a yes decision on 10,000 engineers. So it has to be unbiased, which it's never going to be. It has to scale to this incredible dealing with incredible numbers. It has to be inexpensive for the company. It has to be inexpensive for the applicants. Like, there's just no way that you're
Fulfill
gonna
everything.
satisfy all those constraints at the same time. Still, the best way I know to interview is the pair program, and there are certain people who are going to be excluded in that process. So people on the autism spectrum, even people who might be okay in a social software development situation, but they need to develop relationships first. Those people are just never going to be hired out of a pair programming interview because they're not going to look like they're very good. So, yeah, I don't know. This is a huge problem. I think the more realistic the situation is, the better. But also recognize that there are people who will work well under pressure once they're in a team that'll work terribly under pressure when they're not part of the team. So are you just going to accept that you exclude all those people? You know, I interviewed at Google once and they gave me some dumb system design problem. And the answer was really easy. Oh, put a cache at every node. And I just totally fumbled the question. I started trying to ask, like, what are they really getting at? This has got to be more complicated than this. And yeah, I was out. And so, like, if me with 35 years of experience didn't handle that pressure well, I think it was a false negative. But it's Google, they get to decide and they have all the world's money. So before we ended, I wanted to come back to something you brought up in the beginning, which is in Egypt, you've got a very particular situation and people try to put process over people, which is like I understand it and it's inexcusable. But the situation in Egypt is different than anywhere else. You have your own culture, you have your own set of business constraints. I've done a lot of work in Africa, different parts of Africa, Central Africa, South Africa. And my friend Barry Dwolatsky, who was a professor of Wits University, always talked about in an African context. He always say in an African context. And I thought, yeah, come on, come on, come on. It really is different. He was right, I was wrong. It really is different. And if you take something like extreme programming, even which when I approach a team, that's the perspective, that's the best way I know how to approach how are we going to work together. That it has to be shaped by the context in which you work. That means that you can't instantly roll out a digital transformation to the entire organization. Yeah, boo-hoo. You can do it fast quickly though, if you grow like a tree grows. Right? 1, 2, 4, 8, da, 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 and you can have a big tree and it can get big, but it's not going to get big all at once. And I'd encourage you to explore what that means. What is it? What is different about Egyptian culture that makes, now in my heart of hearts as a geek, I don't think that means, well, test-driven development just isn't going to work. Because it's a TDD is a geeky response to a geeky set of constraints. But like the we're trying to create two things, a rich social network and short feedback loops. And how that plays out in your situation is going to be different than how somebody is going to do it in Japan, or someone's going to do it in Russia, or someone's going to do it in China, or someone's going to do it in Australia. Even in different companies inside of each of those national cultures, what it means to create a rich social network and short feedback loops is going to be different. But the richer we are connected to each other as humans, the more we create together. And the shorter the feedback loops are, the easier it is to create that network, even though sometimes we have conflict, and the more value that we're going to create together. I don't expect that to be the same all over the world. Some of
I
the programming stuff is going to be, it's going to look very familiar place to place, and some of the social stuff is going to look very different. And that's
I
good.
yeah, I think I had my startup in Egypt. I believe the problem is there is a manager and there is a leader. And we don't have enough leaders, and it's like in Egypt, we don't have the technical leaders where you inspires you and give you, it's like, wow, this guy's like, I want to sit beside him and see what he's doing. There is lots of I'm sorry to say it, but there is lots of fakes. It's like people who just became like team leaders because they are the oldest, maybe they have been here for since forever, and they are not inspiring. And they don't like the, there is huge mismatch of energy. It's like when you have like someone young, it's like yeah, give me the world, I can break it. It's like, and it's like, yeah, I hardly walk. This is like a big mismatch. You need someone to match that. It's like if someone is rhyming in a certain wave, it's like you need to take it up with them. It's like you don't say, I'm tired, I can't. If you can't, then you should find a good place for yourself if it's like you can't go with it. But I can for sure say that's like if we have enough energy, it's like the matching energy, leadership. And leadership, again, it's, some people say it's like being a manager. It's like, no, someone might be walking on the street and you consider them a leader because the way they inspire me, that the way they like the values that they have, the things that I appreciate. So as Egyptian, I'm also, we are very oriented to families and like our like social ties, and that's a huge part. It's like it needs more of a brother. It's like I'm not saying it's like it need to be intimate, it's like brothers and sisters, and it's like, no, it's not like that. It's they need to feel the superiority of the person on intellectual level and human level, so they can look at them and learn from them. Because that's like a, I don't know, it's like it feels like a brain shortcut when you like someone. It's like, yeah, this person has what I need, and I will suck it from them. And that's not happening, which makes like all the things going crazy with the management's like, ah, oh, let's have this process, this and that. And while the problem, I always like 100% of like whenever I talk to my friends in Egypt, it's 100% attitude. It's like if this change a little bit, this attitude, the way we hire, it's like even hiring. It's funny because when I had my startup, I used to hire people who don't pass my interviews. It's like because I ask for a certain thing, which is attitude and specific things like, can you come back in a week and it's like answer those questions? Here is the books, here is the questions, and please come back in a week. And they do that. And because they were not ashamed and they look at the book, I actually hire them because that's actually what I need. It's like I need someone I can fill their brain with stuff. So that's my perspective on it. I think we are stepped over the 1 hour, but I had lots of other questions, but yeah,
Well,
talking with you is like, yeah.
I'll just have to come to Egypt. We'll sit down together, have some good food, and we'll finish the conversation.
Yeah, I'm here in California. I moved 6 years ago. So yeah, I'm currently at Apple. So
Oh, then
way from
it's
Egypt.
even easier.
Excuse me?
Then it'll be even easier.
Yes, yeah. That's yeah. I hope we meet someday. It's like you are in San
Absolutely.
Francisco. Yeah.
Yeah,
Cool.
nice and simple.
Yes.
Super. Well, thank you so much for the invitation to start the conversation. One thing I always try to remember is that this is hard because it's really hard. It's not, there's not a simple solution that we're just missing, and if only we, all took the same shot, all the problems would go away. We're dealing with genuinely hard problems about what it really means to be a human being. And so that's why it's difficult. That's why there's no solution. There's no solutions. There's only progress. But I'd rather be making the progress than not be making the progress. And clearly, not making progress is one of the options out there, and because lots of people don't. So
Yes. Thank you so
thank you
much,
so
and
much.
yeah, I really appreciate the time you have put with us, and wish you have a great weekend.
All right. Thanks a
Yeah.
lot. Talk
Okay,
to you soon.
bye.
Bye-bye.